What's a menagerie?
Asked Olive. A collection of animals, Emma explained. Like a zoo, sort of. Olive squeaked and clapped her hands.
It's Cuthbert's friends! From the story! Oh, I can't wait to meet them! Do you suppose that's where the Imbrin lives, too?
At this juncture, Millard said, it's best not to suppose anything.
We started walking. I was still reeling from my encounter with the Hollow. My ability did seem to be developing, as Millard said it would, growing like a muscle the more I worked on it. Once I'd seen a Hollow, I could track it, and if I focused on it in just the right way, I could anticipate its next move in some felt more than known gut instinctual way. I felt a certain satisfaction at having learned something new about my peculiarity, and with nothing to teach me but experience. But this wasn't a safe, controlled environment I was learning in. There were no bumper lanes to keep my ball out of the gutter. Any mistake I made would have immediate and deadly consequences for both myself and those around me. I worried the others would start believing the hype about me, or worse yet, I would. And I knew that the minute I got cocky, the minute I stopped being pants-wettingly terrified of Hollowgast, something terrible would happen. Maybe it was lucky, then, that my terror-to-confidence ratio was at an all-time low. 10-1, easy. I stuck my hands in my pockets as we walked, afraid the others would see them shaking.
Look! Said Bronwyn, stopping in the middle of the path. A house in the clouds!
We were halfway up the ridge. Up ahead of us, high in the distance, was a house that almost seemed to be balanced on a cloud bank. As we walked farther and crested the hill, the clouds parted, and the house came into full view. It was very small and perched not atop a cloud, but on a very large tower constructed entirely from stacked-up railroad ties, the whole thing set smack in the middle of a grassy plateau. It was one of the strangest man-made structures I'd ever seen. Around it on the plateau were scattered a few shacks, and at the far end was a small patch of woods, but we paid no attention. Our eyes were on the tower.
"What is it?"
I whispered.
A lookout tower?
Guessed Emma.
A place to launch airplanes from, said Hugh.
But there were no airplanes anywhere, nor any evidence of a landing strip.
Perhaps it's a place to launch zeppelins from, said Millard.
I remembered old footage of the ill-fated Hindenburg docking to the top of what looked like a radio tower, a structure not so different from this, and felt a cold wave of dread pass through me. What if the balloons that hunted us on the beach were based here, and we'd unwittingly stumbled into a nest of whites?
Or maybe it's the Imbrin's house, said Olive. Why does everyone always leap to the awfulest conclusions right away?
I'm sure Olive's right, said Hugh. There's nothing to be afraid of here.
He was answered right away by a loud, inhuman growl, which seemed to come from the shadows beneath the tower.
What was that? Said Emma. Another Hollow?
I don't think so, I said, the feeling still fading in me.
I don't know, and I don't want to know, said Horace, backing away.
But we didn't have a choice. It wanted to meet us. The growl came again, prickling the hairs on my arms, and a moment later a furry face appeared between two of the lower railroad ties. It snarled at us like a rabid dog, reels of saliva dripping from its fang-toothed mouth.
"What in the name of the Elder Folk is that?"
muttered Emma.
"Capital idea, coming into this loop," said Enoch. "Really working out well for us so far."
The whatever it was crawled out from between the ties and into the sun, where it crouched on its haunches and leered at us with an unbalanced smile, as if imagining how our brains might taste. I couldn't tell if it was human or animal, dressed in rags, it had the body of a man, but carried itself like an ape, its hunched form like some long-lost ancestor of ours whose evolution had been arrested millions of years ago. Its eyes and teeth were a dull yellow, its skin pale and blotched with dark spots, its hair a long, matted nest.
"Someone make it die," Horace said, "or at least make it quit looking at me."
Bronwyn set Claire down and assumed a fighting stance, while Emma held out her hands to make a flame, but she was too stunned, apparently, to summon more than a sputter of smoke. The man-thing tensed, snarled, and then took off like an Olympic sprinter, not toward us, but around us, diving behind a pile of rocks and popping up again with a fang-bearing grin. It was toying with us, like a cat toys with its prey just before the kill. It seemed about to make another run, at us this time, when a voice from behind commanded it to "Sit down and behave!" And the thing did, relaxing onto its hindquarters, tongue lolling from its mouth in a dopey grin. We turned to see a dog trotting calmly in our direction. I looked past it to see who had spoken, but there was no one, and then the dog itself opened its mouth and said, "Don't mind Grunt, he's got no manners at all. That's just his way of saying thank you. That Hologast was most bothersome." The dog seemed to be talking to me, but I was too surprised to respond. Not only was it speaking in an almost human voice, and a refined British one at that, but it held in its jowly mouth a pipe, and on its face were a pair of round, green-tinted glasses.
"Oh, dear, I hope you're not too offended," the dog continued, misinterpreting my silence. "Grunt means well, but you'll have to excuse him. He was, quite literally, raised in a barn. I, on the other hand, was educated on a grand estate, the seventh pup of the seventh pup in an illustrious line of hunting dogs." He bowed as well as a dog could, dipping his nose to the ground. "Addison McHenry, at your humble service."
"That's a fancy name for a dog," said Enoch, apparently unimpressed to meet a talking animal.
Addison peered over his glasses at Enoch and said,
"And by what appellation, dare I ask, are you denominated?"
"Enoch O'Connor," Enoch said proudly, sticking his chest out a little.
"That's a fancy name for a grimy, pudge-faced boy," Addison said,
and then he stood up on his hind legs, rising nearly to Enoch's height.
"I am a dog, yes, but a peculiar one. Why, then, should I be saddled with a common dog's name? My former master called me Boxy, and I despised it, an assault on my dignity, so I bit him on the face and took his name. Addison, much more befitting an animal of my intellectual prowess, I think. That was just before Miss Wren discovered me and brought me here."
Faces brightened at the mention of an Imbrin's name, a pulse of hope firing through us.
"Miss Wren brought you?" said Olive. "But what about Cuthbert the giant?"
"Who?"
Addison said, and then shook his head.
"Ah, right, the story. It's just that, I'm afraid. A story inspired long ago by that curious rock down below, and Miss Wren's peculiar menagerie."
"Told you," muttered Enoch.
"Where's Miss Wren now?" Emma said. "We've got to speak to her."
Addison looked up at the house atop the tower and said,
"That's her residence, but she isn't home at the moment. She winged off some days ago to help her Imbrin sisters in London. There's a war on, you see. I assume you've heard all about it, which explains why you're travelling in the degraded style of refugees."
"Our loop was raided," said Emma, "and then we lost our things at sea."
"And nearly ourselves," Millard added.
At the sound of Millard's voice, the dog startled.
"An invisible! What a rare surprise! And an American, too," he said, nodding at me. "What a peculiar lot you are. even for peculiars.
He fell back onto all fours and turned toward the tower.
Come, I'll introduce you to the others. They'll be absolutely fascinated to meet you. And you must be famished from your journey, poor creatures. Nutrifying provender shall be forthcoming.
We need medicine, too, said Bronwyn, kneeling to pick up Claire. This little one is very ill.
We'll do all we can for her, the dog said. We owe you that and more for solving our little Hollowghast problem. Most bothersome, as I was saying.
Nutrifying what, did he say? Said Olive.
Sustenance! Comestibles! Rations! The dog replied. You'll eat like royalty here.
But I don't like dog food, said Olive.
Addison laughed, the timbre surprisingly human.
Neither do I, miss.
Chapter 4
Addison walked on all fours with his snub nose in the air, while the man-thing called Grunt scampered around us like a psychotic puppy. From behind tufts of grass and the shack scattered here and there, I could see faces peeking out at us, furry, most of them, and all of different shapes and sizes. When we came to the middle of the plateau, Addison reared up on his hind legs and called out,
"Don't be afraid, fellows! Come and meet the children who dispatched our unwelcome visitor!"
One by one, a parade of bizarre animals ventured out into the open. Addison introduced them as they came. The first creature looked like the top half of a miniature giraffe sutured onto the bottom half of a donkey. It walked awkwardly on two hind legs, its only limbs.
"This is Deirdre," said Addison. "She's an emu-raff, which is a bit like a donkey and a giraffe put together, only with fewer legs and a peevish temper. She's a terrible sore loser at cards," he added in a whisper. "Never play an emu-raff at cards. Say hello, Deirdre."
"Goodbye,"
Deirdre said, her big horse lips pulling back into a buck-toothed grin.
"Terrible day, very displeased to meet you."
Then she laughed, a braying, high-pitched whinny, and said,
"Only teasing!"
"Deirdre thinks she's quite funny," Addison explained.
"If you're like a donkey and a giraffe," said Olive, "then why aren't you called a donkey-raffe?"
Deirdre frowned and answered,
"Because what kind of an awful name is that? Emu-raffe rolls off the tongue, don't you think?"
And then she stuck out her tongue, fat, pink, and 3 feet long, and pushed Olive's tiara back on her head with its tip. Olive squealed and ran behind Bronwyn, giggling.
"Do all the animals here talk?" I asked.
"Just Deirdre and I," Addison said. "And a good thing, too. The chickens won't shut up as it is, and they can't say a word."
Right on cue, a flock of clucking chickens bobbled toward us from a burned and blackened coop.
"Ah!"
said Addison.
"Here come the girls now."
"What happened to their coop?" Emma asked.
"Every time we repair it, they burn it down again," he said. "Such a bother."
Addison turned and nodded in the other direction.
"You might want to back away a bit when they get excited." Bang!
A sound like a quarter stick of dynamite going off made us all jump, and the coop's last few undamaged boards splintered and flew into the air.
"Their eggs go off,"
he finished. When the smoke cleared, we saw the chickens still coming toward us, unhurt and seemingly unsurprised by the blast, a little cloud of feathers wafting around them like fat snowflakes. Enoch's jaw fell open.
"Are you telling me these chickens lay exploding eggs?" he said.
"Only when they get excited," said Addison. "Most of their eggs are quite safe and delicious, but it was the exploding ones that earned them their rather unkind name, Armageddon chickens."
"Keep away from us!"
Emma shouted as the chickens closed in.
You'll blow us all up!
Addison laughed.
They're sweet and harmless, I assure you, and they don't lay anywhere but inside their coop.
The chickens clucked happily around our feet.
You see? The dog said. They like you!
This is a madhouse, said Horace.
Deirdre laughed.
No, Doveling. It's a menagerie.
Then Addison introduced us to a few animals whose peculiarities were subtler, including an owl who watched us from a branch, silent and intense, and a cadre of mice who seemed to fade subtly in and out of view, as if they spent half their time on some other plane of reality. There was a goat, too, with very long horns and deep black eyes, an orphan from a herd of peculiar goats who once roamed the forest below. When all the animals were assembled, Addison cried,
Three cheers for the Hollow Killers!
Deirdre brayed, and the goat stamped the ground, and the owl hooted, and the chickens clucked, and Grunt grunted his appreciation. And while all this was going on, Bronwyn and Emma kept trading looks, Bronwyn glancing down at her coat where Miss Peregrine was hiding, and then raising her eyebrows at Emma to ask, Now? And Emma shaking her head in reply, Not quite yet. Bronwyn laid Claire in a patch of grass beneath a shade tree. She was sweating and shivering, fading in and out of consciousness.
There's a special elixir I've seen Miss Wren prepare for treating fever, Addison said. Foul tasting, but effective.
My mom used to make me chicken soup, I offered. The chickens squawked with alarm, and Addison shot me a nasty look.
He was joking, he said. Only joking, such an absurd joke. Ha ha! There's no such thing as chicken soup.
With the help of Grunt and his opposable thumbs, Addison and the emu Raff went to prepare the elixir. In a little while they returned with a bowl of what looked like dirty dishwater. Once Claire had drunk every drop and fallen back asleep, the animals laid out a modest feast for us. Baskets of fresh bread and stewed apples and hard-boiled eggs, of the non-exploding variety, all served straight into our hands, as they had no plates or silverware. I didn't realize how hungry I'd been until I wolfed down 3 eggs and a loaf of bread in under 5 minutes. When I was done, I belched and wiped my mouth and looked up to see all the animals looking back, watching us eagerly, their faces so alive with intelligence that I went a little numb and had to fight an overwhelming sensation that I was dreaming. Millard was eating next to me, and I turned to him and asked, Before this, had you ever heard of peculiar animals?
Only in children's stories, he said through a mouthful of bread.
How strange, then, that it was one such story that led us to them.
Only Olive seemed unfazed by it all, perhaps because she was still so young, or part of her was, anyway, and the distance between stories and real life did not yet seem so great.
Where are the other animals? She asked Addison. In Cuthbert's tale, there were stilt-legged grim bears and two-headed lynxes.
And just like that, the animal's jubilant mood wilted. Grunt hid his face in his big hands, and Deirdre let out a neighing groan.
Don't ask! Don't ask! She said, hanging her long head.
But it was too late.
These children helped us, Addison said. They deserve to hear our sad story, if they wish.
If you don't mind telling us, said Emma.
I love sad stories, said Enoch. Especially ones where princesses get eaten by dragons and everyone dies in the end.
Addison cleared his throat.
In our case, it's more that the dragon got eaten by the princess, he said. It's been a rough few years for the likes of us, and it was a rough few centuries prior to that.
The dog paced back and forth, his voice taking on a preacherly kind of grandness.
Once upon a time, this world was full of peculiar animals. In the Alden days,
there were more peculiar animals on earth than there were peculiar folk. We came in every shape and size you could imagine. Whales that could fly like birds, worms as big as houses, dogs twice as intelligent as I am, if you can believe it. Some had kingdoms all their own, ruled over by animal leaders. A spark moved behind the dog's eyes, barely detectable, as if he were old enough to remember the world in such a state. And then he sighed deeply. The spark snuffed and continued. But our numbers are not a fraction of what they were. We have fallen into near extinction. Do any of you know what became of the peculiar animals that once roamed the world? We chewed silently, ashamed that we didn't.
Right then, he said. Come with me, and I'll show you.
And he trotted out into the sun and looked back, waiting for us to follow.
Please, Addy, said the emu Raff. Not now, our guests are eating.
They asked, and now I'm telling them, said Addison. Their bread will still be here in a few minutes.
Reluctantly, we put down our food and followed the dog. Fiona stayed behind to watch Claire, who was still sleeping, and with Grunt and the emu Raff loping after us, we crossed the plateau to the little patch of woods that grew at the far edge. A gravel path wound through the trees, and we crunched along it toward a clearing. Just before we reached it, Addison said,
May I introduce you to the finest peculiar animals who ever lived?
And the trees parted to reveal a small graveyard filled with neat rows of white headstones.
Oh, no,
I heard Bronwyn say.
There are probably more peculiar animals buried here than are currently alive in all of Europe, Addison said, moving through the graves to reach one in particular, which he leaned on with his forepaws. This one's name was Pompeii. She was a fine dog, and could heal wounds with a few licks of her tongue. A wonder to behold! And yet this is how she was treated.
Addison clicked his tongue, and Grunt scurried forward with a little book in his hands, which he thrust into mine. It was a photo album, opened to a picture of a dog that had been harnessed, like a mule or a horse, to a little wagon.
She was enslaved by carnival folk, Addison said, forced to pull fat, spoiled children like some common beast of burden, whipped even with riding crops.
His eyes burned with anger.
By the time Miss Wren rescued her, Pompeii was so depressed she was nearly dead from it. She lingered on for only a few weeks after she arrived, then was interred here.
I passed the book around. Everyone who saw the photo sighed, or shook their head, or muttered bitterly to themselves. Addison crossed to another grave.
Grander still was Cab Magda, he said, an 18-tusked wildebeest who roamed the loops of Outer Mongolia. She was terrifying. The ground thundered under her hooves when she ran. They say she even marched over the Alps with Hannibal's army in 218 BC. Then, some years ago, a hunter shot her.
Grunt showed us a picture of an older woman who looked like she'd just gotten back from an African safari, seated in a bizarre chair made of horns.
I don't understand, said Emma, peering at the photo. Where's Cab Magda?
Being sat upon, said Addison. The hunter fashioned her horns into a chair.
Emma nearly dropped the album.
That's disgusting!
If that's her, said Enoch, tapping the photo, then what's buried here? The chair, said Addison. What a pitiful waste of a peculiar life. This burying ground is filled with stories like Magda's, Addison said. Miss Wren meant this menagerie to be an ark, but gradually it's become a tomb.
Like all our loops, said Enoch. Like peculiar dumb itself. A failed experiment.
"This place is dying," Miss Wren often said. Addison's voice rose in imitation of her. "And I am nothing but the overseer of its long funeral."
Addison's eyes glistened, remembering her, but just as quickly went hard again.
"She was very theatrical."
"Please don't refer to our Imbrin in the past tense," Deirdre said.
"Is," he said. "Sorry, is."
"They hunted you," said Emma, her voice wavering with emotion. "Stuffed you and put you in zoos."
"Just like the hunters did in Cuthbert's story," said Olive.
"Yes," said Addison. "Some truths are expressed best in the form of myth."
"But there was no Cuthbert," said Olive, beginning to understand. "No giant, just a bird."
"A very special bird," said Deirdre.
"You're worried about her," I said.
"Of course we are," said Addison. "To my knowledge, Miss Wren is the only remaining uncaptured Imbrin. When she heard that her kidnapped sisters had been spirited away to London, she flew off to render assistance without a moment's thought for her own safety."
"Nor ours," Deirdre muttered.
"London?" said Emma. "Are you sure that's where the kidnapped Imbrins were taken?"
"Absolutely certain," the dog replied. "Miss Wren has spies in the city, a certain flock of peculiar pigeons who watch everything and report back to her. Recently, several came to us in a state of terrible distress. They had it on good information that the Imbrins were, and still are, being held in the punishment loops."
Several of the children gasped, but I had no idea what the dog meant.
"What's a punishment loop?" I asked.
"They were designed to hold captured whites, hardened criminals, and the dangerously insane," Millard explained. "They're nothing like the loops we know. Nasty, nasty places."
"And now it is the whites, and undoubtedly their hollows, who are guarding them," said Addison.
"Good God!" exclaimed Horace. "Then it's worse than we feared!"
"Are you joking?" said Enoch. "This is precisely the sort of thing I feared."
"Whatever nefarious end the whites are seeking," Addison said, "it's clear that they need all the Imbrins to accomplish it. Now only Miss Wren is left, brave, foolhardy Miss Wren, and who knows for how long."
Then he whimpered the way some dogs do during thunderstorms, tucking his ears back and lowering his head. We went back to the shade tree and finished our meals, and when we were stuffed and couldn't eat another bite, Bronwyn turned to Addison and said,
"You know, Mr. Dog, everything's not quite as dire as you say."
Then she looked at Emma and raised her eyebrows, and this time Emma nodded.
"Is that so?"
Addison replied.
"Yes, it is. In fact, I have something right here that may just cheer you up."
"I rather doubt that,"
the dog muttered, but he lifted his head from his paws to see what it was anyway. Bronwyn opened her coat and said,
"I'd like you to meet the second-to-last uncaptured Imbrin, Miss Alma Peregrine."
The bird poked her head out into the sunlight and blinked. Now it was the animal's turn to be amazed. Deirdre gasped, and Grunt squealed and clapped his hands, and the chickens flapped their useless wings.
"But we heard your loop was raided," Addison said. "Your Imbrin stolen."
"She was," Emma said proudly. "But we stole her back."
"In that case," said Addison,
bowing to Miss Peregrine,
"it is a most extraordinary pleasure, madam. I am your servant. Should you require a place to change, I'll happily show you to Miss Wren's private quarters."
"She can't change," said Bronwyn.
"What's that?" said Addison. "Is she shy?"
"No," said Bronwyn. "She's stuck."
The pipe dropped from Addison's mouth.
Oh, no, he said quietly. Are you quite certain?
She's been like this for 2 days now, said Emma. I think if she could change back, she would have done it by now.
Addison shook the glasses from his face and peered at the bird, his eyes wide with concern.
May I examine her? He asked.
He's a regular Dr. Doolittle, said the emu Raff. Addy treats us all when we're sick.
Bronwyn lifted Miss Peregrine out of her coat and set the bird on the ground.
Just be careful of her hurt wing, she said.
Of course, said Addison.
He began by making a slow circle around the bird, studying her from every angle. Then he sniffed her head and wings with his big, wet nose.
Tell me what happened to her, he said finally. And when and how. Tell me all of it.
Emma recounted the whole story. How Miss Peregrine was kidnapped by Golan. How she nearly drowned in her cage in the ocean. How we'd rescued her from a submarine piloted by whites. The animals listened, rapt. When we'd finished, the dog took a moment to gather his thoughts, then delivered his diagnosis.
She's been poisoned. I'm certain of it. Dosed with something that's keeping her in bird form artificially.
Really? Said Emma. How do you know?
To kidnap and transport Imbrins is a dangerous business when they're in human form and can perform their time-stopping tricks. As birds, however, their powers are very limited. This way, your mistress is compact, easily hidden, much less of a threat.
He looked at Miss Peregrine.
Did the white who took you spray you with anything? He asked her. A liquid or a gas?
Miss Peregrine bobbed her head in the air, what seemed to be a nod. Bronwyn gasped.
Oh, miss, I'm so awfully sorry. We had no idea.
I felt a stab of guilt. I had led the whites to the island. I was the reason this had happened to Miss Peregrine. I had caused the peculiar children to lose their home, at least partly. The shame of it lodged like a stone in my throat. I said, "She'll get better, though, won't she? She'll turn back?"
"Her wing will mend," Addison replied. "But without help, she won't turn human again."
"What sort of help does she need?" Emma asked. "Can you give it to her?"
"Only another Imbrin can assist her, and she's running very short on time."
I tensed. This was something new.
"What do you mean?" Emma said.
"I hate to be the bearer of bad news," said Addison. "But 2 days is a very long time for an Imbrin to be arrested like this. The more time she spends as a bird, the more her human self will be lost. Her memory, her words, everything that made her who she was, until eventually she won't be an Imbrin at all anymore. She'll just be a bird, for good and ever."
An image came to me of Miss Peregrine, splayed on an emergency room table, buzzed around by doctors, her breathing stopped, every second that ticked by doing her brain some new and irreparable harm.
"How long?" asked Millard. "How much longer does she have?"
Addison squinted, shook his head.
2 days, if she's strong."
Whispers and gasps. We collectively went pale.
"Are you sure?" said Emma. "Are you absolutely, positively certain?"
"I've seen it happen before."
Addison padded over to the little owl, who was perched on a branch nearby.
"Olivia here was a young Imbrin, who had a bad accident during her training. They brought her to us 5 days later. Miss Wren and I did everything we could to try to change her back, but she was beyond help. That was 10 years ago. She's been this way ever since."
The owl stared mutely. There was no life in her any more beyond that of an animal. You could see it in the dullness of her eyes. Emma stood. She seemed about to say something, to rally us, I hoped, kick us into action with some inspiring speech, but she couldn't seem to get the words out. Choking back a sob, she stumbled away from us. I called after her, but she didn't stop. The others just watched her go, stunned by the terrible news, stunned, too, by any sign of weakness or indecision from Emma. She had maintained her strength in the face of all this for so long that we had come to take it for granted. But she wasn't bulletproof. She might have been peculiar, but she was also human.
"You'd better fetch her, Mr. Jacob," Bronwyn said to me. "We mustn't linger here too long."
When I caught up to Emma, she was standing near the plateau's edge, gazing out at the countryside below, sloping green hills falling away to a distant plain. She heard me coming but didn't turn to look. I shuffled up next to her and tried to think of something comforting to say.
"I know you're scared, and 3 days doesn't seem like a long time, but..."
"2 days," she said. "2 days, maybe."
Her lip trembled.
"And that's not even the worst of it."
I balked. How could things possibly be worse? She'd been waging a battle against tears, but now, in a sudden break, she lost it. She sank to the ground and sobbed, a storm overtaking her. I knelt and wrapped my arms around her and hung on.
"I'm so sorry," she said,
repeating it 3 times, her voice raw, a fraying rope.
"You never should have stayed. I shouldn't have let you, but I was selfish, so terribly selfish."
"Don't say that," I said. "I'm here. I'm here and I'm not going anywhere."
That only seemed to make her cry harder. I pressed my lips to her forehead and kissed it until the storm began to pass out of her, the sobs fading to whimpers.
"Please talk to me," I said. "Tell me what's wrong."
After a minute, she sat up, wiped her eyes, and tried to compose herself.
"I had hoped I'd never have to say this," she said, "that it wouldn't matter. Do you remember when I told you, the night you decided to come with us, that you might never be able to go home again?"
"Of course I do."
"I didn't know until just now how true that really was. I'm afraid I've doomed you, Jacob, my sweet friend, to a short life trapped in a dying world."
She drew a quivering breath, then continued.
"You came to us through Miss Peregrine's loop, and that means only Miss Peregrine or her loop can send you back. But her loop is gone now, or if it isn't yet, it will be soon, which leaves Miss Peregrine herself as your only way home. But if she never turns human again..."
I swallowed hard, my throat dry. "Then I'm stuck in the past."
"Yes. And the only way to return to the time you knew as your own would be to wait for it. Day by day, year by year."
70 years. By then, my parents and everyone I ever knew or cared about would be dead, and I'd be long dead to all of them. Of course, provided we survived whatever tribulations we were about to face, I could always go and find my parents in a few decades, once they were born. But what would be the point? They'd be children, and strangers to me. I wondered when my present-day back-home parents would give up on finding me alive. What story they'd tell themselves to make sense of my disappearance? Had I run away? Gone insane? Thrown myself off a sea cliff? Would they have a funeral for me? Buy me a coffin? Write my name on a gravestone? I'd become a mystery they would never solve, a wound that would never heal.
"I'm so sorry,"
Emma said again,
If I'd known Miss Peregrine's condition was so dire, I swear to you, I never would have asked you to stay. The present means nothing to the rest of us. It'll kill us if we stay here too long. But you still have family, a life.
No! I said, shouting, slapping the ground with my hand, chasing away the self-pitying thoughts that had started to cloud my head. That's all gone now. I chose this.
Emma laid her hand atop mine and said gently,
If what the animals say is true, and all our Imbrins have been kidnapped, soon even this won't be here.
She gathered some dirt in her hand and scattered it in the breeze.
Without Imbrins to maintain them, our loops will collapse. The whites will use the Imbrins to recreate their damned experiment, and it'll be 1908 all over again. And either they'll fail and turn all creation into a smoking crater, or they'll succeed and make themselves immortal, and we'll be ruled by those monsters. Either way, before long we'll be more extinct than the peculiar animals, and now I've dragged you into this hopeless mess. And for what?
Everything happens for a reason, I said. I couldn't believe those words had come out of my mouth, but as soon as they were spoken, I felt the truth of them resonating in me loud as a bell. I was here for a reason. There was something I was meant not simply to be, but to do. And it wasn't to run or hide or give up the minute things seemed terrifying and impossible.
I thought you didn't believe in destiny, said Emma, assessing me skeptically.
I didn't, not exactly, but I wasn't quite sure how to explain what I did believe either. I thought back to the stories my grandfather used to tell me. They were filled with wonder and adventure, but something deeper ran through them as well, a sense of abiding gratitude. As a kid, I'd focused on Grandpa Portman's descriptions of a magical-sounding island and peculiar children with fantastic powers, but at heart, his stories were about Miss Peregrine, and how, in a time of great need, she had helped him. When he arrived in Wales, my grandfather had been a young, frightened boy who didn't speak the language, a boy hunted by two kinds of monsters, one that would eventually kill most of his family, and the other, cartoonishly grotesque and invisible to all but him, which must have seemed lifted directly from his nightmares. In the face of all this, Miss Peregrine had hidden him, given him a home, and helped him discover who he really was. She had saved his life, and in doing so had enabled my father's life, and by extension, my own. My parents had birthed and raised and loved me, and for that I owed them a debt. But I would never have been born in the first place if not for the great and selfless kindness Miss Peregrine had shown my grandfather. I was coming to believe I had been sent here to repay that debt, my own, my father's, and my grandfather's, too. I tried my best to explain. It's not about destiny, I said, but I do think there's balance in the world, and sometimes forces we don't understand intervene to tip the scales the right way. Miss Peregrine saved my grandfather. And now, I'm here to help save her. Emma narrowed her eyes and nodded slowly. I couldn't tell if she was agreeing with me or thinking of a polite way to tell me I'd lost my mind. Then she hugged me. I didn't need to explain any further. She understood. She owed Miss Peregrine her life, too. We've got 3 days. I said. We'll go to London, free one of the Imbrins, and fix Miss Peregrine. It's not hopeless. We'll save her, Emma, or we'll die trying. The word sounded so brave and resolute that for a moment I wondered if it was really me who'd said them. Emma surprised me by laughing, as if this struck her as funny somehow, and then she looked away for a moment. When she looked back again, her jaw was set, and her eyes shone. Her old confidence was returning.
"Sometimes I can't decide whether you're completely mad or some sort of miracle," she said, "though I'm starting to think it's the latter."
She put her arms around me again, and we held each other for a long moment, her head on my shoulder, breath warm on my neck. And suddenly, I wanted nothing more than to close all the little gaps that existed between our bodies, to collapse into one being. But then she pulled away and kissed my forehead and started back toward the others. I was too dazed to follow right away, because there was something new happening. A wheel inside my heart I'd never noticed before, and it was spinning so fast it made me dizzy. And the farther away she got, the faster it spun, like there was an invisible cord unreeling from it that stretched between us, and if she went too far, it would snap and kill me. I wondered if this strange, sweet pain was love. The others were clustered together beneath the shade tree, children and animals together. Emma and I strode toward them. I had an impulse to link arms with her, and nearly did, before something caught me and I thought better of it. I was suddenly aware, as Enoch turned to look at us with that certain suspicion he always reserved for me and, now, increasingly, for both of us, that Emma and I were becoming a unit apart from the others, a private alliance with its own secrets and promises. Bronwyn stood as we approached. "Are you all right, Miss Emma?"
"Yes, yes," Emma said quickly. "Had something caught in my eye, was all. Now everyone gather your things. We must go to London at once, and see about making Miss Peregrine whole again."
"We're thrilled you agree," Enoch said with an eye roll. "We came to the same conclusion several minutes ago, while you two were over there whispering."
Emma flushed, but she declined to take Enoch's bait. There were more important things to attend to now than petty conflicts, namely, the many exotic dangers of the journey we were about to undertake.
"As I'm sure you're all aware," Emma said, "this is, by most standards, a very poor plan with little hope of success."
She laid out some of the reasons why. London was far away, not by the standards of the present-day world, maybe, when we might have GPS'd our way to the nearest train station and caught an express that would have whisked us to the city center in a few hours. In 1940, though, in a Britain convulsed by war, London was a world away. The roads and rails might be clogged by refugees, or ruined by bombs, or monopolized by military convoys, any of which would cost us time Miss Peregrine didn't have to spare. Worse, we would be hunted, and even more intensely than we had already been, now that nearly all the other Imbrins had been captured.
"Forget the journey," said Addison. "That's the least of your worries. Perhaps I was not sufficiently dissuasive when we discussed this earlier. Perhaps you do not fully understand the circumstances of the Imbrins' incarceration."
He enunciated each syllable as if we were hard of hearing.
"Haven't any of you read about the punishment loops in your peculiar history books?"
"Of course we have," said Emma.
"Then you'll know that attempting to breach them is tantamount to suicide. They're death traps, every one of them, containing the very bloodiest episodes from London's history. The Great Fire of 1666, the exceedingly lethal Viking siege of 842, the pestilent height of the terrible plague. They don't publish temporal maps of these places for obvious reasons. So unless one of you has a working knowledge of the secretest parts of peculiardom..."
"I am a student of obscure and unpleasant loops," Millard spoke up.
been a pet hobby for many years.
Bully for you, said Addison. Then I suppose you have a way to get past the horde of hollows who will be guarding their entrances as well.
Suddenly it felt like everyone's eyes were on me. I swallowed hard, kept my chin high, and said,
Yeah, in fact we do.
We'd better, grumbled Enoch.
Then Bronwyn said,
I believe in you, Jacob. I haven't known you too long, but I feel I know your heart, and it's a strong, true thing, a peculiar heart, and I trust you.
She leaned against me and hugged my shoulder with one arm, and I felt my throat tighten.
Thank you,
I said, feeling lame and small in the face of her big emotion. The dog clucked his tongue.
Madness! You children have no self-preservation instincts at all. It's a wonder any of you are still breathing.
Emma stepped in front of Addison and tried to shut him down.
Yes, wonderful, she said. Thank you for illuminating us with your opinion. Now, doomsdaying aside, I have to ask the rest of you. Are there any objections to what we're proposing? I don't want anyone volunteering because they feel pressured.
Slowly, timidly, Horace raised his hand.
If London is where all the whites are, won't going there be walking right into their hands? Is that a good idea?
It's a genius idea, Enoch said irritably. The whites are convinced we peculiar children are docile and weak. Us coming after them is the last thing they'd expect.
And if we fail, said Horace, we'll have hand-delivered Miss Peregrine right to their doorstep.
We don't know that, said Hugh, that London is their doorstep.
Enoch snorted.
Don't sugarcoat things. If they've broken open the prison loops and they're using them to keep our Imbrins, then you can bet your soft parts they've overrun the rest of the city too. It'll be absolutely crawling with them, mark my words. If it weren't, the whites would never have bothered coming after us in little old Cairnholm. It's basic military strategy. In battle, you don't aim for the enemy's pinky toe first. You stab him right through the heart.
Please, Horace moaned. Enough talk of smashing loops and stabbing hearts. You'll frighten the little ones. I ain't scared, said Olive.
Horace shrank into himself. Someone muttered the word coward.
None of that, Emma said sharply. There's nothing wrong with being frightened. It means you're taking this very serious thing we're proposing very seriously. Because, yes, it will be dangerous. Yes, the chances of success are abysmal. And should we even make it to London, there's no guarantee we'll be able to find the Imbrins, much less rescue one. It's entirely likely that we'll end our days wasting away in some whitish prison cell, or dissolved in the belly of a hologast. Everyone got that?
Grim nods of understanding.
Am I sugarcoating anything, Enoch?
Enoch shook his head.
If we try this, Emma went on, we may well lose Miss Peregrine. That much is uncontroversial. But if we don't try, if we don't go, then there's no question we'll lose her, and the whites will likely catch us anyway. That said, anyone who doesn't feel up to it can stay behind.
She meant Horace, and we all knew it. Horace stared at a spot on the ground.
You can stay here where it's safe, and we'll come collect you later, when the trouble's through. There's no shame in it. My left ventricle, said Horace. If I sat this out, I'd never live it down.
Even Claire refused to be left behind.
I've just had 80 years of pleasantly boring days, she said, raising up on one elbow from the shady spot where she'd been sleeping. Stay here while the rest of you go adventuring. Not a chance.
But when she tried to stand, she found she couldn't, and lay back again, coughing and dizzy. Though the dishwatery liquid she'd drunk had cooled her fever some,
There was no way she'd be able to make the journey to London. Not today, not tomorrow, and certainly not in time to help Miss Peregrine. Someone would have to stay behind with Claire while she recuperated. Emma asked for volunteers. Olive raised her hand, but Bronwyn told her to forget it. She was too young. Bronwyn started to raise her own hand, then thought the better of it. She was torn, she said, between wanting to protect Claire and her sense of duty to Miss Peregrine. Enoch elbowed Horace.
"What's the matter with you?" Enoch taunted. "Here's your big chance to stay behind."
"I want to go adventuring. I really and truly do," Horace insisted. "But I should also like to see my 105th birthday, if at all possible. Promise we won't try to save the whole blasted world."
"We just want to save Miss P," said Emma. "But I make no guarantees about anyone's birthday."
Horace seemed satisfied with this, and his hands stayed planted at his sides.
"Anyone else?" said Emma, looking around. "It's all right," Claire said. "I can manage on my own."
"Out of the question," said Emma. "We peculiar stick together."
Fiona's hand drifted up. She'd been so quiet I'd nearly forgotten she was sitting with us.
"Fee, you can't," said Hugh.
He looked hurt, as if by volunteering to stay behind she was rejecting him. She looked at him with big, sad eyes, but her hand stayed in the air.
"Thank you, Fiona," said Emma. "With any luck, we'll see you both again in just a few days."
"Bird willing," said Bronwyn.
"Bird willing," echoed the others.
Afternoon was slipping toward evening. In an hour, the animal's loop would be dark, and finding our way down the mountain would be much more dangerous. As we made preparations to leave, the animals kindly outfitted us with stores of fresh food and sweaters spun from the wool of peculiar sheep, which Deirdre swore had some peculiar property, though what exactly it was she couldn't quite remember.
"Impervious to fire, I think, or perhaps water. Yes, they never sink in water like fluffy little life jackets. Or maybe, I don't know. They're warm in any case."
We thanked her and folded them into Bronwyn's trunk. Then Grunt came loping forward holding a package wrapped up with paper and twine.
"A gift from the chickens,"
Deirdre explained, winking, as Grunt pressed it into my hands.
"Don't drop it."
A smarter person than I might have thought twice about bringing explosives along on our trip, but we were feeling vulnerable. And both the dog and Emu Raff swore that if we were gentle with the eggs, they wouldn't go off. So we nestled them carefully between the sweaters in Bronwyn's trunk. Now, at least, we wouldn't have to face men with guns without weapons of our own. Then we were nearly ready, except for one thing. When we left the animal's loop, we'd be just as lost as when we'd come in. We needed directions.
"I can show you the way out of the forest," said Addison. "Meet me at the top of Miss Wren's tower."
The space up top was so small that only two of us could fit at a time, so Emma and I went, climbing its railroad ties like the rungs of a giant ladder. Grunt monkeyed his way up in half the time, delivering Addison to the top under one arm. The view from the top was amazing. To the east, forested slopes stretched away to a vast barren plain. To the west, you could see all the way to the ocean, where an old-looking ship rigged with giant complicated sails glided down the coast. I'd never asked what year it was here, 1492, 1750, though to the animals I guess it hardly mattered. This was a safe place apart from the world of people. And only in the world of people did the year make any difference.
"You'll head north," Addison said,
jabbing his pipe in the direction of a road, just visible, tracing through the trees below like a faint pencil-drawn line.
"Down that road is a town, and in that town, in your time anyway, is a train station. Your medium of interloop